So how did Ireland join the anti-apartheid movement? Like, what did they do? You mentioned it a little bit earlier, but right now is your time to make your country shine.
Thanks, Melanie. Yeah, no, it's such a fascinating. I mean, this is yeah, I've written a little bit about this, but I'm dying for someone else to take up my story because I wrote about the period, the first maybe 12 years of the Irish anti-apartheid movement, 11 actually. But you know, this it is an absolutely fascinating story. So like one of the reasons it's so fascinating, and I'll give you a sense now of where exactly it emerged, but this is important just as a background. So, you know, in Irish kind of in the Irish kind of nationalism or the story of Irish independence, the Irish who fought alongside the Boers against the British in the Boer War in the early 20th century was a really critical story, right? And right up to the 1950s, you know, this identification between, you know, Irish nationalism and Boer nationalism, which then becomes really problematic after 1948, you know, because then basically you're supporting. So it's really problematic for a country that says it's, you know, anti-imperialism to then be kind of saying, well, you know, we like the Boers though, you know, but okay, right, what how do we do this? How do we figure this out? And one of the things that happens is that Ireland, when it joins the UN in 1955, becomes actually very outspoken on anti-colonial issues, and one of those is actually apartheid. And Ireland is actually the first Western European country, along with I think Greece is the only other European country, but Ireland's the first Western European country to actually vote on a res for a resolution that condemned apartheid at the UN. So you know, from the beginning, like this kind of, which is very strong kind of in the Irish kind of identity post this creation of the state in 1922, this kind of sense of anti-colonialism, you know, and anti kind of oppression. And so that's in the air, if you see what I mean, you know, this that sense, you know, that you should identify with those groups who are oppressed. But the actual mechanics of setting up a movement here, so there is a little bit of outrage in 1960 after the Sharpeville massacre, which obviously has ripple effects because it partly helps to create the British anti-apartheid movement. And the British movement is important here because one of the guys who was really heavily involved in the British movement was called Kader Asmal, Asmal. And he was a South African Muslim who had moved to Britain. He was actually a lecturer in law, and his wife Louise, who's British, they were both heavily involved with the British anti-apartheid movement from 1960. But then Kader Asmal moved to Dublin in 1963 to become a lecturer in Trinity College in Dublin. And like this is the real minutiae of this, but the reason it's really important is because then when he was in Ireland, in Dublin, when Nelson Mandela and the Rivonia group were on trial in 1964. And so use that kind of the publicity that came with that, you know, because it was obviously in the newspapers, to number one, have a kind of a public discussion about apartheid in Dublin, and then to set up a movement. And this, you know, this movement, it's really interesting because it became strong very quickly, actually. Because of the way I think the tactics that they used were very clever, they really pushed the sports boycott, actually. It was really important for them. And so, you know, there's a really significant incident in January 1970 when the Springboks, the South African rugby team, came to Dublin. And, you know, you had, you had about 10,000 marchers on the street in protest against the game going ahead. You know, they lay down in front of the South African team bus as it left the airport when they arrived. You know, the match had to go ahead behind. There was bales of straw and barbed wire around the pitch to try and stop any protesters from getting out of the crowd and onto the pitch. And so this was very visible. Now, the reason why that's obviously important in an Irish context is because the late 1960s is the start of the Troubles and the kind of the rise of in Northern Ireland, the rise of this kind of really strong kind of activism against oppression. So some people come from the north to protest against this too, and link it to that. And then the Irish movement kind of, you know, it manages also very cleverly, and I don't actually know an awful lot about the Canadian case, so I can't really compare. But the Irish case, what they did very cleverly was they said, okay, we'll get people from all different sectors of society. We'll get people from different political groupings. We'll get people from different kind of religions, and we'll get them all, and we'll organize them together. And then they very prominently, used campaigns, boycotts of African goods, et cetera, to really draw attention to what they were doing and to get people engaged, and then they used their missionary connections as well, because Ireland has a lot of Catholic missionaries in South Africa to some extent, but this is much more kind of a secular movement. And the other campaign, which is really, really important then to flag, and it gives a good sense of how strong the movement was here, is in 1984, there was a trade union, probably a resolution given through the trade unions in Ireland not to handle South African goods. And one of the things that came out of that was a very small union called IDATU. That's not the right union. Anyway, two members of that union, one in particular, she was working in a supermarket, and she was on the, I think you call it a checkout as well, do you, in Canada, the person putting through the things, through the till. And it came to a grapefruit, and it was from South Africa. She refused to handle it. She eventually was disciplined by the company. It's Dunstores, his name is one of the major supermarket chains here. She was disciplined by the company, and this led her and some of her colleagues to go on strike. They were on strike for 2.5 years, and eventually won, basically, because the Irish government eventually banned South African fruit and veg from their stores. And so this ban for imports of South African fruit and veg. But this incident was really prominent because it linked, the Irish case all the way around the world. It wasn't actually, the key thing here as well is it wasn't actually run by the anti-apartheid movement. They weren't members of the movement. So this was the way in which the idea had kind of developed outwards and people were aware of it. And so that kind of sense of a link between that kind of activism against oppression and then this kind of public or popular kind of activism. And so it always kind of bubbled under all the time. And actually, by in 1990, Kader Azmal, who was the guy I mentioned earlier on, he was the chairman of the Irish anti-apartheid movement, he actually went back to South Africa and was a minister in the first ANC government in 1994. So, he actually was very prominent. So they had very strong international links as well. And, they were linked very strongly, obviously, to Britain because it's our neighbour, but also to other movements around Europe, the Nordic states, very strong, to the United States, and again, to the UN's activism. And so they were also collecting money for the International Defence and Aid Fund, which is the fund that the anti-apartheid movement used globally to raise money for families of those affected by apartheid. So they were linked to all these different things, and I think in an Irish context is probably successful as well because it was a way of expressing opposition to oppression in a context which is very difficult for Irish people because, obviously from 1968 you have, from 68 to 98, obviously there's very serious violence happening in Northern Ireland. And that became a tricky thing for a lot of Irish people to, while they might be nationalist, could they support that kind of violence? But then something like anti-apartheid, where to a lot of people it was more clear cut, if you see what I mean, it was just, that's racism. And so that, it was, I think a lot of energy went that direction because it was, because that was, okay, I can support that. That's really simple. Okay. And that's why the sports boycott worked so well here, because they could just say, here's a rugby team. How many black players do you see? None. And that's the way the anti-apartheid movement did it. It was really clever. And, very visually said, here it is. And it's so obvious, and built on that and built on that and built on that. And actually the strike that I mentioned in the 80s is the real kind of high point of it then, that you get this, you know, mass the numbers are actually very small to go on strike, but the kind of the media attention that it gets then is ginormous, and the international attention. And so it becomes this major, major issue, which forces the government to change its policies. But yeah, it's a really significant part of the international movement, actually. And I'm not just saying that because this is where I'm from, but I think it was actually, and partly driven by the South African who was driving it himself, you know. And that, I think that's a very important element of the whole global anti-apartheid movement, which makes it very different from a lot of other movements in that South Africans were very prominent in it and in driving it, you know. And Ireland obviously very much is, you know, we here, because we're so relatively close to a city like London, you know, it only takes a plane to get to Dublin, you know, and like now it's only an hour, like less than an hour. So, you know, that it's, you know, if there's exiles based in London or in London on speaking tours, they came here. So that kind of, you know, that link helps to kind of foster more protest and kind of keep it on the agenda all the time.